I am ready to talk.
Me too.
I am ready to tell it all.
Let's open up.
I am ready to incriminate some people.
Let's talk in robotic voices.
Yes, let's do precisely that.
No, let's not do that.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, we can. I mean, do your best robot voice.
Man, bro, robot.
Beep, do, boop.
Beep, boop. Execute. Beep, boop.
Exterminate.
Error.
Wait, what was it? Critical process fail?
Bad pool data in address 0x05CFBDF.
Squeaky lobster? Anyway.
Panic.
At the disco.
Welcome to a robot podcast with occasional tech references. This is Hope This Helps.
The podcast.
I'm Steve.
I'm Tiffany.
I am Steve Bot.
Tiff Bot.
Steve died 15 years ago. This is the Steve Bot.
Tiff was never alive.
In the first place.
Yeah, no, Bot was always a bot.
Oh, no, don't say that.
No. Skynet.
Yeah, that's okay. that's like pulling the curtain back and realizing that it was all fake.
Oh, no, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah, we got really dark.
Yeah, we did for like 2 seconds. Welcome to the best episode ever of Hope This Helps. Where we talk about dark things like Skynet and Tiff never being alive. Yeah. This sounds like that show Black Mirror.
Yes.
All over again.
Or Schrodinger's cat.
Schrodinger's cat? Yeah, but I don't want to be referenced to it like a dead cat.
Well, we're kind of going in that direction. So whether you like it or not, it's kind of happening unless we change course now.
All right, fine. Let's go. Ready, set, go.
Go. Where are we going to?
Let's boot up. As a robot, do your best boot up noise.
Beep, beep, beep. Bow. I'm degaussing.
That was so good.
This robot has CRT eyes. So you got to degauss.
Mine would be something like,
sure, whatever floats your boat.
Whatever boots you up and gets your boot on.
As long as secure boot is disabled.
Yes. Turn that boot off.
Yes. So.
All right.
We have real things to discuss one of these days.
He's lying.
In some way or another. No, I swear we do.
We do. So. At one point in time, we said something about Docker, and we may have lied a little bit.
Yes, so I can't exactly remember when this happened, but I think I might have said at some point that Microsoft bought Docker, and it turns out I was actually really mistaken. Microsoft has not purchased Docker. Microsoft attempted to buy Docker maybe a couple of years ago, but the attempt did not succeed. They are currently in a partnership, which is why Docker is in Azure so prevalently, along with Kubernetes. But it is not officially owned by Microsoft, at least not yet, as far as I understand. I think I might have gotten it confused with the GitHub acquisition. Something about that just sounded the same to me. It could have just been open source Linux world community kind of thing. But just as a clarification, Docker is not owned by Microsoft as of right now, at the very least.
I'm wondering if it was almost one of those cart before the horse situations, because when you do put it into Google, Docker owned by Microsoft, it is one of the pop-ups, like the auto-completes. So we're not the only people who thought it, or at least look for it.
Right. That was actually something I tried to verify myself too, because I saw that autocomplete as well. And I was like, oh, was I actually right? But then when I dug into it, the only thing I could really find was articles from years ago saying Microsoft was in talks to buy Docker, but nothing ever developed past that. So just to keep it clear, Microsoft does not own Docker as of right now.
So. Right. That could definitely change in the future. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, for example, I just saw today Zoom is going to start using Oracle infrastructure. Why? I don't know. Who knows?
Really? Well,
yeah.
For just database backend or for everything?
Yeah, for their backend as a like trusted partner.
Oh, okay. That's
they're putting a lot of their confidence in Oracle.
That's an interesting place to put your confidence, I guess. Were they having performance issues, or is this just kind of a scaling up kind of operation?
I think it's both scaling up operation and as well as trying to securely just be secure, something they failed miserably at.
That is right, yeah.
Couple of months. So Oracle does stuff. I can't tell you what they do well, but they do stuff.
They certainly do things like making Java endlessly more complicated. But yeah, the Zoom CEO, I think he hired an advisory board for security operations and improving all the things that they were doing wrong. So I think that just could be step one and a million steps of them trying to correct the problems they've had. I don't know. Zoom will be zoomy. You know what annoys me?
What annoys you?
Websites that have really stupid password complexity requirements.
Oh my sweet baby.
And I'm not even talking about like ones that are overly complicated. I'm talking about ones that are not complicated enough. So I recently actually basically broke a website where I had to sign up to make an account to get access to some training material. And when I made my account and randomly generated my account password in KeePass, I did a regular 20-digit random character string with letters, numbers, characters, basically the whole nine. And when I made this password, I repeatedly kept getting the page just not doing anything when I clicked register. And I first thought, okay, maybe it was Adblock. Let's turn off Adblock. Anything? No. NoScript? Let's disable NoScript. No. All right. Entirely different browser. Edge? Same thing. Still not getting anywhere. Let's try a whole another computer on a whole another network. So let's try a work laptop on the VPN, maybe on a different server entirely, not even my laptop on the VPN, just anything. No. Instead, I just got occasional errors. Turns out, after I went back and forth with support a bunch of times, they finally said, and this baffles me as to how they figured this out. I don't know how they were somehow able to maybe decrypt my password, but they said, please don't use left or right brackets in your password. And I was like, okay, that's a really odd requirement. You didn't state anywhere on your website that there were limitations to your password complexity requirements where I couldn't include brackets. So, all right, weird flex, but let me try removing the brackets from my password. And then it accepted it. But it's like, okay, so we have a couple of problems here. If you're going to have password complexity requirements, at least be upfront with them. This website, I will not name it, this website did not include what I could and could not put in a password, and yet the field did not restrict me as to how long or how complex the password could be. And when I entered a character that was illegal, it just didn't give me an error whatsoever in 90% of the browsers and computers that I tried it on. It only gave me an error just by chance when I was on a certain network with a certain browser. And that's just no good. You know, if you're a website, you need to have really good, first of all, really strong and decent standard password complexity requirements, and B, give me a little hint as to what you can and cannot put in this field, just so I'm not sitting there guessing for like 2 hours trying to figure out if it's me or the website or my network or browser or whatever it is, because that's really annoying. So that's the really annoying web thing of the week that I don't like, is sites with password complexity landmines.
I agree with that. It's so frustrating too, because there's no uniformity to how passwords are. So you'll go into a site and you will type in a password and you're like, I'm pretty sure I used that password for this site. And then you realize that you can't use special characters or you can't use this thing or that thing. And then you have 20 variations of passwords for things, which I get it. You want to be secure and all that stuff. But who realistically can keep track of everything if you're not using a password manager for your personal life?
Right. And I can deal with having different unique random passwords for everything because I just live my life out of KeePass. But it's just like unbelievable when a website then kind of actively fights me in trying to make a password that is really secure, or if I have to strip it down to be really insecure where it says, oh, you can't have it be this long. Oh, it can only be numbers and letters. And then the thing that kills me the most is there was one particular forum I signed up for because I just needed some support for this really niche and unique product I had. And the forum sign up actually emailed me in plain text what my password was, which is unbelievable. You know, you can't just email me what my password is because that could be intercepted in God knows how many ways.
That's just embarrassing.
I believe this forum was like a very, very old version of PHPBB, which was probably from the mid-2000s and just never updated. It certainly looked like it, but man, it sure had the security of the mid-2000s as well. It wasn't a big deal to me because, of course, it was a unique password, as it should be, you know, just for a real baseline of security purposes. But wow, it was just fighting me every step of the way. I couldn't have a very complex password, and B, man, that just emailing me in plain text, that's just another mark against your website.
Yeah, that's really embarrassing.
Yeah, so that's the state of passwords on the internet. So, you know what's also annoying? You know what's the annoying Windows bug of the week this week? So I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know how often you use the run box in Windows. I personally use it quite a bit. It's just, for me, it's just faster to hit Windows R and just type a command I have memorized to just get to somewhere really fast. It's faster than the start menu's latent search feature, and even faster than everything search in a lot of cases, where I can just hit Windows R, real simple box, type my thing, PowerShell, CMD, DXDiag, Control.exe, and maybe a million other little things that I could just think of off the top of my head. WinWord, Excel, you name it. But what's really annoying is, as of around, I think this might have started in about Windows 8, and it has gone all the way through Windows 10, occasionally the run box does not remember your historical commands. So in the run box, you can hit a dropdown on that box, and it will, when it works, it'll remember your past commands, and it makes it even easier to type because you can just start typing the beginning of it and it will just auto-complete in the little box that shows up under the text field. Well, in Windows 10, I want to say more than half the time, this box is empty almost every time I open this thing. So in order to invoke some commands that might be a little bit more complex than normal, for example, if I want to get to the classical sound control panel and not have to go through the annoying settings app, I would have to hit control.exe/name microsoft.sound. And I'm not exactly a robot, despite what I did at the beginning of this episode, and I occasionally need to look this up. And it's stored in my OneNote. OneNote takes a little while to load and search and everything. It would be nice if it was in the autocomplete, where I've, you know, run this command almost every week for Hope This Helps. But particularly in Windows 10 and several computers running Windows 10, and after several OS reinstallations, the open historical command box just kind of clears itself out depending on which computer I'm using. It's really annoying. So I filed a bug in the feedback hub, and I don't know, that's my personal way of reporting this to Microsoft, but it's kind of one of those stupid little annoying Windows bugs that I swear was 100% reliable until one day it suddenly wasn't.
Boogie. Yeah, I haven't really run into too many bugs recently. No, this week. Oh, the Teams migration service had a bug in it where calendars, where if they migrated over from Skype for Business, they were like totally freaking out. And it was causing a little bit of chaos in my org, but it looked like it might have been a little bit more widespread than just us. And Teams itself has actually been a bit overwhelmed as far as users. Microsoft just announced their numbers. They have jumped 70% users to 75 million daily active users.
Wow, that's a stress test if I could ever.
Yeah, and I have to say, it is handling the load despite some minor annoyances.
Oh, that's good. I have a question about the calendar bit of Skype for Business. So usually Skype will read an Exchange calendar, right? Is mm-hmm. that's usually the source of truth for Skype for Business? So you'd imagine Correct. That transitioning to Teams, that shouldn't, in theory, really muck with anything?
So what happens is there's a meeting migration service that runs, and if you are at all familiar with old Skype for Business on-prem or Link, there was a meeting migration tool that you could use to migrate meetings to O365 if you've ever had to do that before. If you're using conference dial-in numbers, you want to migrate those meetings over so that you can still utilize them as Teams meetings or Skype current version meetings. So Microsoft has done something really nifty, and they built the meeting migration tool where as soon as you run the command to upgrade the Teams policy, it'll automatically migrate the user's calendar, which is really nifty and awesome. However, there are a few caveats to it, and you can run into some minor issues. We did run into a couple of issues where users were getting put, they were dialed into a meeting, and they were getting put into two existing meetings, or two separate meetings entirely, even though it was for one meeting. So minor things like that could happen during the migration that were interrupted.
Yes. It doesn't really, it's always like, it doesn't matter what video conferencing or conferencing software it is, the dual meeting bug is always a problem, because we had that issue with RingCentral as well. I think it might have been actually a global issue where Zoom and RingCentral would create a dual meeting where sometimes if the wrong people joined at the wrong time, they would get put into a separate meeting room that was disconnected from the host's meeting room.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
And years ago, I've seen this problem actually also happen with Adobe Connect, where the same exact issue happened. So it's funny how this bug seems to travel between from platform to platform, no matter what year it is, what situation it is. I think that's really funny.
Yeah, no, it is pretty funny, but not for the user.
Oh, absolutely not. It's frustrating for the user.
It's you just really don't know frustrating what to do. For them. Yeah, they just end up recreating it, but they're like, why? Why is this like this?
Yeah. Okay, so that answers my question then as to, because I first thought, I was like, why would Skype for Business be screwing with the calendar? But if it's making a transition between Skype and Teams for the dial-in numbers and the, you know, mapping X to Y for each platform, then that's probably where it gets screwed up.
That's exactly where it gets screwed up. So if you never have to deal with dial-in numbers and those types. I mean, realistically, too, when you do switch everyone over to Teams only mode and you have all the Skype for Business only meetings, you're going to want to convert those over to Teams meetings anyways, or have everyone automatically do that.
Right. Or yeah. They risk having to, you know, do it by hand or whatever.
Right. And you don't want to do that.
Yep. Yeah, most C-levels or whatever won't stand for that because fixing things like that is hard somehow.
I mean, of 8,000 users that I migrated, I only had problems with about 20.
That is a really good failure rate, actually.
And it wasn't the tool's fault. It was primarily a hybrid scenario and things not being where we thought they were.
Yeah, but regardless, that's like a less than 1% failure rate, I think, if my math is correct. So you know what, that's congratulate yourself over that. That's a good one.
Yeah, no, it's pretty good. I'm not complaining.
Mm-hmm. So I've been working on trying to get video synced to my Zunes, and man, that's been a rocky roller coaster, which was unexpected. So with the Windows 10, I believe, anniversary update, the Zune software lost a feature where it could natively convert videos to the Zune-capable format, be it a Zune standard def, which is a 3080 or 120, or a Zune HD. They only accepted very specific video formats back in the day. The Zune 3080 and 120 only accepted certain flavors of WMV video, if I'm not mistaken, and some AVI if you were really lucky. The Zune HD would accept certain MP4s and of course the backward compatible WMV format. The issue I ran into is I'm trying to find a different piece of software that can do this conversion and figure out what those exact settings were, because in the Zune software, it just did it. If you clicked Zune, sync to my Zune, it would just start converting and it would send it over. But now we're living in 2020 where Zunes have not become the dominant MP3 player in the world, or smartphone, or anything really. We have to resort to really esoteric internet research and we're kind of on our own in terms of syncing the files and figuring out what works. So I tried a couple of different possibilities. One was using Handbrake, which is my preferred video converter of choice, which is open source and pretty flexible. But it turns out, once upon a time, Handbrake used to convert be able to convert videos to the Zune format, but either due to licensing or codec evolution or something, Handbrake actually lost the ability to convert for Zune HDs and standard Zunes at some point. There is no longer the specific H.264 or MP4 format that was friendly to the Zune HD in Handbrake anymore. In fact, a whole bevy of options has been removed from Handbrake since then. I found a guide, but it doesn't apply to the current version of Handbrake. So my next thought was, okay, what did I do back in the day? What did I do in like 2007 to 2011 for the Zunes? So there was an encoder I had back in the day called MediaCoder, which I guess it did an okay job. So ironically, I still had the installer for this program on my computer, but I Googled around and I checked. I was like, is this still actively developed software? Turns out it is. It's still chucking on just as it was before. So I downloaded the latest version and I found an old article from a long time ago where someone had a preset for MediaCoder for the Zune HD. So I've downloaded that and I was able to successfully convert a movie with this preset. The only thing as of right now, I haven't attempted to sync that to my Zune yet, but I am hopeful that that is going to work. That is for the Zune standard, for the Zune 80, which is the standard definition Zune. I have not tried this yet for the Zune HD and I'm hoping that it will work just as well. So I'm disappointed that Handbrake didn't work out, but hey, if I can do it with MediaCoder, that'll be just fine. Someone else also had recommended a program called iPodMe, which was a program converter for iPods. I did attempt to use this, but unfortunately the program is very, very slow. It claims it's multi-threaded, but I have not observed that it is capable of that. I threw three standard length full-featured movies into it, and to convert one movie, it was taking over 2 hours before I finally killed it. And I was like, I'm not waiting for this. I'd rather have my computer do folding at home than spend all this time converting these movies for a very niche purpose. So I think that idea is probably dead and gone at this point, and I'm not entirely confident in that route. So that's the state of Zune video conversion, the state of the Zunian for the week of April 29th, if you will. And yeah, that's my current world. It's still unconfirmed, but hopefully we have some movement with on the MediaCoder front.
That'll be so exciting. I remember Handbrake. That was also my favorite.
Yeah, Handbrake,
video decoder.
Handbrake is still very good. I still do use it if I want to convert videos to a more standard MP4 format. If I get like an AVI or something from back in the day, it usually can make it the standard Apple compatible format, mm-hmm. or which in turn compresses it fairly well, and it's a pretty modern format that most modern devices use. But when it comes to the Zune, I gotta make it a little strange for that device.
I really enjoy that you're still trying to make the Zune work.
I will make it work, damn it. In 2020.
Damn it.
Particularly the Zune HD. The Zune HD has a really nice OLED display, and it's such a tiny, nice little device. And I now have an HD AV dock for it, which would be nice just for offline media consumption on an HD TV, you know, with no reliance on NAS or network connectivity or the cloud or a streaming service or anything like that. So I don't know. It'll be to be continued.
I'm excited about the state of the Zunian.
Yes. Woo. It's alive and well.
All right. So you have taken an Azure training. And yeah, You're pretty excited about it.
Yeah. So I am taking Azure training. I'm trying to familiarize myself in the land of the Azures. And because at least in the Microsoft world, that is their baby. That is very much where they are focused on. That's where they want a lot of the industry to move, especially with infrastructure, IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS. And particularly where I'm working, we want to move there rather quickly and hastily. So the time is of the essence to learn how to particularly operationalize, deploy, and get very familiar and comfy in the Azure world. So one of the best ways to accomplish this is via Azure ARM templates, which is the Azure Resource Manager. And you can start with the initial Azure web interface for creating these templates. A lot of the way Azure works is you can kind of familiarize yourself by creating these. You can go through the wizards to create resource groups and build out your VMs, your networks, your resources, all that kind of stuff. But if you really want to get advanced with it and be really efficient with it, you deploy using either the Azure CLI or the AZ commandlets in PowerShell. You can deploy JSON files, which are templates containing all of the information pre-baked into a configuration file, essentially, and then you use the command to just point at it and deploy it, which is really helpful if you want to just deploy VMs using all these nifty, wonderful presets that Microsoft put in. You can set up your network infrastructure and everything like that. The nice thing about particular resource manager templates is that they are cumulative. So if you want, you can start with a really, really simple JSON file for just defining, say, your virtual network or your subnets and what have you. You can deploy that first. And once you verify you have that built, you can then start adding on to it. You could say, okay, I built my resource group with all my stuff underneath it. Let's maybe try adding a virtual machine. We can set up usernames and passwords. We could set up IP addresses. And you can keep building and building on top of the same one. It's kind of nice that it's cumulative in that sense. And you can either use the Azure CLI, which is, it appears to be more kind of bash or non-PowerShell dependent, or you can use the Azure commandlets, whichever kind of floats your boat in that sense. I personally think doing it this way is way better than the web UI. I've been, in my own personal experience, the web UI has been rather confusing to me, despite Microsoft's best efforts to organize everything in Azure and make it kind of understandable. It's still a big mouthful. There's just panels and settings and buttons and switches and everything in every single which way. And it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, I know what I want to do. I just don't know where to click and how to click and how to get it all mashed together. And when you just have a single template file that just kind of has it all laid out in front of you, and you can control F your way through everything and not have to click through all these mystery boxes and things that appear and disappear in the web UI, it just feels simpler somehow to do it all in the command line interface. So that's where I've been trying to go. That's the direction I've been trying to move with Azure. It also means you can automate this a whole lot better, or at least it prepares you for that. Some challenges I've figured out where I've wanted to deploy a couple of other things rather than just the resource manager templates. I wanted to deploy a Kubernetes cluster. And Kubernetes is basically a cluster of Docker containers. So if you can imagine a single Docker container, like on the Raspberry Pi or whatever, imagine that in Azure, and then imagine a million of them as part of like an ecosystem. That is what Kubernetes is in a nutshell. Just think of it as container clusters. It's just a fancy word. So to deploy that, you can start in the web UI, and then when you get to the very end of the wizard, there is a download automation template that you can download. And I attempted to download that. I got it, and I was able to mostly get it kind of working until I got completely hard stopped by a few errors where I couldn't get a couple of service principal credential IDs, and it was just kind of, it was a strange, almost artificial error that, oddly enough, the web UI doesn't tell you about. There's just a big button that says download this thing to make it automatable. And when I downloaded it, I expected it to just work, and it just didn't. So I think there's something to do with Azure Key Vault. I haven't quite dove into it just yet, and this might be to be continued, but that's the state of at least deploying an AKS cluster, which is Azure Kubernetes Services cluster stuff, with the command line. It's possible I'm just not quite there yet with the knowledge, but it's one of those things where I'm just going to sink a few hours into it here and there to hopefully save myself some hours later on, you know, when it counts more. That's kind of the whole point of learning and figuring out automation. But that was my experience with figuring out at least Kubernetes and ARM templates and that kind of stuff.
Yay, that sounds really exciting.
Yeah,
I don't know anything about it.
It's definitely daunting. I feel I know more and less about Azure after this week of training. So for anyone interested, the training I took was AZ-104, Microsoft Azure Administrator. It is sort of a sequel slash follow-up to AZ-103.
Okay. And
I have taken the AZ-103 exam at Microsoft Ignite. I went in blind. I knew nothing about it, and I almost passed it, funny enough. It was one of the only exams I took at Ignite where I actually became within a stone's throw of passing. So,
oh, wow.
I kind of was able to sort of feel my way around in the dark with it, but I'd rather I actually know what I'm doing as opposed to just guessing and testing really well. So, but other than that, lastly, one of the other things I tried, at least in the training labs, was deploying Docker containers in Azure. And this is really cool because I just succeeded in doing this at home, not in Azure, but on the Raspberry Pi. So this was fresh in my mind and it was really interesting to me. And I think this is really the future of how like you're going to deploy things. Like, we have VMs now, but I don't think we're going to have VMs forever. I think it's going to be transitioning to more Docker containers, and then those Docker containers will be organized into Kubernetes clusters. So I really think that's kind of the future. And a lot of the major cloud providers like AWS support these kind of things. And
it's, oh, definitely. They're very popular.
At least for now, it's kind of an open standard. Is particularly Docker is. I don't remember exactly how open Kubernetes is. I assume it is probably about the same.
I think it is about the same. And then isn't there another one that's very popular as well?
Yes.
Why can't I think of it?
The name escapes me.
It's a really silly name.
Yeah. But yeah, my point is, yeah, Docker is it's less resource intensive than VMs because you don't have to run a whole OS. You're just running only what you need in a very minimalistic sense, but it's secure and it's all standardized and it's scalable, which is one of the most important things. That's one of the whole points of Kubernetes. You can scale up and scale down your stuff. And it's just makes it really easy with all the kubectl command in particular. So yeah, I know I sound like someone who just freshly read a whole book on this, and I may not know everything I'm talking about, but this is all really, really exciting to me.
You're so excited.
Yeah, even though I probably won't be able to use much of any of this in a production context in quite some time, but we'll get there someday.
It's still pretty cool to learn, though.
Yeah, for a while I kind of was feeling like I didn't have anything new to learn, but hey, got the doors blown off of that now.
Nice. That's excellent.
Yeah. Azure Blob Storage is also another cool thing.
I love Azure Blob Storage.
I mean, the name is cute, but
the
whole concept, Azure Blob Storage is a little bit easier to wrap your head around. It's literally just storage in Azure, and you just have to figure out, hey, how do I manage it up there? And the PowerShell commandlets are really broad in scope, and you can do a whole lot. And the lab that I did on that was really cool. Kind of more straightforward. It makes a lot more sense. The Azure Storage Explorer is a whole separate Windows app that you can download and use, and it's pretty straightforward.
It was far more complicated. They definitely have made it easier to use.
Right, yeah. It was one of those things where, like, from a distance, I thought the application was a whole lot more confusing than it actually ended up being. Once you know where to click, it's pretty simple. It's just storage and storage is storage.
Right, it's almost like removable storage. That's it.
Yeah, effectively. So, yeah. So other than that, that's been my adventures in Azure. I'm trying to see if I can figure out. I have two exam vouchers, one for AZ-900, which is like the really, really, really high level Azure Fundamentals course. And then I have a voucher for AZ-104. So hopefully I'm going to try to maybe figure out some way of studying for these and maybe take them again. We'll say fingers crossed, but let's see. We'll see where this takes us.
I realized that I was still on mute.
Oh, don't you love it when that happens?
I do. It avoids the blank of me just talking anyways. No one wants to hear me talk.
I disagree.
I disagree entirely.
I think 15 episodes of this disagrees, but you know, it is what it is.
And we're still going. So, terminals.
So, terminals.
And we don't mean like plane or train terminals, because for all intents and purposes, those are still pretty empty.
No, we're talking about the terminals that people still use every single day and the things that get people to and from work every single day. We're talking about the digital terminals. Particularly in this context, the Windows terminal.
Dun, dun, dun.
So Windows Terminal is an up-and-coming application from Microsoft that basically takes your previous Windows PowerShell and Windows Command Prompt or Unix Terminal, PuTTY, you name it, kind of rolls it all into one application. It finally gives us tabs for terminals, which is something that I've wanted for years at this point. And not only that, it also incorporates new features such as the Azure Cloud Shell, Windows Subsystem for Linux, PowerShell 7.
Wait, hold the phone. Azure Cloud Shell?
Azure Cloud Shell is supported in Windows Terminal, yes.
Whoa!
In fact, I don't think you even have to do anything to even install it. I think if you load Windows Terminal from the Windows Store, if I click the little drop-down next to the new tab, I actually get Azure Cloud Shell as an option in here. I believe the only thing you have to do is just install Windows Terminal. I could be wrong, but I think that is a default feature, which is something which...
You probably have to have the Azure Cloud Shell subscription or like have a subscription to Azure.
Right, yeah, or if you have a free account, I think you can at least connect. But right. Yeah, that is an option where you can just connect right from there. And I personally have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have 6 options in my terminal because I have Windows PowerShell 5.1, I have PowerShell 7, I have PowerShell 7 Preview, I have my Ubuntu shell, I have the classical CMD, and I have Azure Cloud Shell in my particular option set for Windows Terminal. And usually the two that I use the most are PowerShell 7 and the Windows Subsystem for Linux, which is effectively just an Ubuntu shell, but I use that to jump as a jump terminal for my Raspberry Pi and my router, where, in as I talked about in previous episodes, it's kind of my management point and it's replaced PuTTY for the most part for just jumping to those boxes and doing things like with Docker or IP tables or what have you. So, sorry, I lost my train of thought there when I was literally staring at the window. So you can do a whole lot with Windows Terminal. The only thing is it's a little esoteric, particularly with its settings. So Windows Terminal's settings are entirely done via a JSON file, which is located kind of deep inside your app data local packages, microsoft.windowsterminal_localstate_settings.json file. But inside there is where you can set things like what do you want your default shell to be when you first open the program? What do you want your font sizes to be? What do you want the transparency of the window to be? Do you want a GIF as your background in your shell or whatever? All kinds of little fun settings. I kind of had some fun with it. I have PowerShell 5.1 with a GIF background of something from Pulp Fiction. It's where John Travolta's kind of walking around a room pacing, kind of going like, hey, what's going on here? And that's kind of a reminder to myself, you should really be using PowerShell 7 and not 5.1 if you can, whenever possible. And then PowerShell 7, I have a nice little acrylic background.
That's pretty awesome.
It is. You can make it your own when you modify this file. It's just a matter of just kind of getting used to the JSON format if you're not used to it.
Okay. That's not too bad, though.
Yeah. There are some missing features, and actually there's one real show-stopping feature, personally, that I can't quite wrap my head around just yet, and that is, since the Windows Terminal program is a Windows Store app, it's a quote-unquote UWP app, it's a secure, trusted Windows application, so it doesn't run like most Win32 applications, which unfortunately means you can't run it as another user. So if you were working in an organization where your privileged account is a separate account than the one that you log into your computer with, you cannot actually run Windows Terminal as this user, at least not without some crazy, unnecessary workaround. So for the most part, for when it comes to work from my actual machine, I can't quite use this program yet. And there is an open issue on GitHub for Windows Terminal about this, but the pages stem at least like 5+ pages, and it seems like at the moment it's not really a prioritized feature at the moment.
Right.
So it's a little bit disheartening to see that, but we'll see where that goes in terms of its life cycle.
That's really frustrating.
Yeah. The program is still in preview, I believe, so maybe we'll get there. They have to get to 1.0 first, and then they'll add more features on. Right. So maybe it's just not that high of a priority at the moment.
It'll get there.
And then another feature, which I personally think is the worst of all, is, you know how in PowerShell, if you have a PowerShell window open, like an actual Windows PowerShell window,
Yeah.
And you hold down control, shift, and then scroll your mouse wheel backwards.
Yeah.
You can change the transparency. Well, unfortunately, that's not in Windows Terminal at the moment. Ooh. I think that is a total showstopper, and I think we should pick it outside
it just ruins everything. Done.
Absolutely. It's a complete, that's what we call in the industry, a complete and total non-starter. So, yes, that is an overview of Windows Terminal. I just like it for the, I like it mostly for the tabs, honestly, and just how I can have multiple shells and I don't have to open PuTTY anymore. It's just kind of a nice little application, which has its growing pains and features that I wish would make it more friendly, or at least one-to-one with past methods of shell usage. And I wish it had a bit of a better settings management page than it currently has, but we'll get there. That's Windows Terminal for you.
That'll happen.
My experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I now have to check it out. It sounds really cool.
Yeah. No, it's free to download in the Windows Store. It's a Windows Terminal preview, and it's there waiting for you.
Go from there. It's calling my name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm like Moana.
It's how far you'll go.
Not very far. To my bed, back to my desk.
Yep.
That's about it. Our favorite topic, Mozzarella Firefox. I mean, I love mozzarella, but... Ooh,
the mozzarella Foxfire. No,
the Foxfire.
How to secure your mozzarella Foxfire.
Don't cook it.
Yeah, you need to run it at a reasonable temperature and make sure it's, you know, you have its proper fixins on it or condiments. I don't know.
Whatever floats your boat.
Yeah. So yes, I am talking about Mozilla Firefox. So In case no one understood that, I don't know. I never quite understand what the internet understands.
Mm-mm.
So just to be safe, yes, we are talking about Mozilla Firefox. Needless to say, I prefer Mozilla Firefox for privacy and security over anything that Microsoft and Google are offering for their browsers. I prefer the Gecko engine over the WebKit engine, and it just has more customizability and historical value to me than anything in the WebKit world. So, particularly the extension world of Firefox is more advanced and developed than the others for in the privacy realm, and I just feel a whole lot safer when browsing with it. My particular setup, I've gone through several iterations of how locked down I want it to be and how stringent I want it to be, and a balance of convenience versus practicality. And at the moment, I think I have it at a fairly good balance, at least for my personal use of Firefox. So kind of as a groundwork, I'll use Firefox container tabs stacked on top of Firefox multi-account containers. So these two extensions work hand in hand, where each tab of Firefox is isolated in its own container instance, effectively. Sort of like Docker, where it lives in its own world. The data is not easily leaked out into another tab, which would include cookies or website data or stuff that could track you across the internet, at least at the browser level. When it comes to the network level, we'll talk about that. So that's a really good baseline. You can configure the Firefox container tabs to have special customized tabs that you come up with yourself, and you can configure websites to open in those container tabs as you see fit or automatically go into them if you want some consistency or you want some cookies to remain persistent on your system. But if you don't want that, there is another extension called temporary containers in Firefox, where by default, Firefox does not open a new tab or website in a container. It just puts it in a non-container, which is sort of like a DMZ, kind of just anything goes kind of zone where data can be shared between whatever website. But temporary containers adds another layer of security where it will create a new throwaway container for a website, and it will keep it all stored in there, and it will discard it once you close the tab, which makes it really nice. And that combined with the container tabs feature and the multi-account containers extension, that kind of creates a nice little isolation system for any website, not just Google, not just Facebook, but any website, from kind of intermingling with each other and keeping your data a little bit more safe. But not quite done also. There is the cookie auto-delete extension, which will handle cleanup of additional cookies, like third party or whatever. And it just adds another layer of making sure that lingering data does not remain in Firefox. You can configure it so that when a tab is closed, it will clear the cookies for that particular website. You can also provide graylisting or whitelisting. So graylisting means the cookies will persist as long as the browser is still open and the process is running. And whitelisting means the cookies will remain on the system regardless. And it has awareness for Firefox container tabs. So these can be configured on a per tab basis, as well as persistent containers versus not. And that makes it really helpful. And lastly, well, not so much lastly, but getting close to lastly, there's also extensions such as uBlock Origin. That probably basically needs no introduction. That has a lot of built-in protections on its own for any website, for not only ad blocking, but tracker blocking, or it can even go as far as blocking scripts or trackers or social things. However strict or lenient you want it to be is up to you. And if you are incredibly paranoid, there's also NoScript, which does overlap with uBlock Origin in a couple of key areas, but it also can make it even more safe if you're going to websites that have a tendency to have overactive JavaScript or things that can tend to hijack your browsing experience or whatever. The only problem with NoScript, at least in my personal opinion, is that it's a little, you have to do a lot of manual work to get a lot of websites to work. You have to either whitelist the whole tab to basically get anything to load, or you have to be really patient and start very carefully and over time whitelisting all of your sites to your preference, which can get really annoying if you tend to go to just random websites and you have to do this every single time. So NoScript is not for everyone. It's definitely for those who like to tweak or have extra granular control over each website and making sure that you can approve or deny things that come through your browser. And lastly, there is a Homograph disablement extension that you can use, which is alternately configurable through the about config through the network.idn_show_punycode property. And this has to do with certain things that can cause a browser hijack via a prompt that might appear on a spoofed website through DNS or a similarly spelled but different website, such as maybe goggle.com trying to go to google.com. That's an old classic example. And so you can either do this through the about.config property, or you can use the no homograph extension, which is downloadable from Mozilla's site. Whichever one, it's kind of a nice little extra layer of security. But yeah, those, so largely a lot of what Firefox's data protection initiatives revolve around, at least from a more advanced sense, is the container tabs and the cookie handling that isolates data and makes sure that things don't leak out or you can't accidentally share data with a site you don't intend to. And that's something I just haven't quite really seen in a whole lot of other browsers, or at least other browsers haven't quite upfront stated that they are actively protecting you against. So I hope that was a little primer on how to accurately secure your Mozilla Foxfire.
I think that's really intuitive, and I really like containers in Mozilla Foxfire.
Yes, that was my first exposure to containers, and it actually helped me really grasp the concept of containers in general. Mm-hmm. So you start with little things like container tabs, then you move to Docker, and suddenly you're talking about Kubernetes, which I couldn't even pronounce maybe 2 months ago. So
yeah, Kubernetes is a fun one to say.
You sound really smart when you start talking about that. You're like, hey, back off, man. I'm a scientist. I know Kubernetes.
I know Kubernetes.
Like don't f with me, man. I got Kubernetes.
The Kubernetes. I have a certificate in Kubernetes. Oh, what's my favorite one? Master Anna Planner.
Ooh, yes. a professional Anna Planner.
But I think the title is Master Anna Planner.
That is like the official legit.
Yeah, you can become a Master Anna Planner.
I really wish I was in the PR meeting when they yeah. decided that
just
one.
No,
say
the times five times as fast. Master and a planner, master and a planner, master and a planner.
Or just write it on a whiteboard yeah. and try not to rearrange it with your eyes.
Right.
And realize what it actually almost says.
Right.
Because if you have dyslexia, man, Anaplan is not a place to work.
The anagram of Anaplan is not...
Yeah, just the anagram of that company is hilarious.
Right.
Just think about it. And Anaplan, if you're listening, you might want to think about
it. You might want to think about it, because we're not the only ones who are laughing hysterically at it. Sorry, Anaplan.
I just remember that one time we had to create an email alias for them, and we almost misspelled it when we were making it.
Yeah, or the time that building a server for it as well.
Oh, that too. Oh, I forgot. Yeah, we built a server for that once.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Just be careful not to mistype that one. That was the quote.
Don't get that wrong in production. That would be a really funny and embarrassing mistake you have to
make. That's what someone said to me as I was typing in to create it. They were like, don't mistype that one.
Yeah. Because... People will ask questions.
I mean, what's the difference than having a server called Casper?
Exactly.
People
will start asking questions. That's the
right. That is the kicker here.
That is the moral of the story for that one.
How to not get promoted to not working at your company anymore.
Yeah.
That. So. All right.
If anyone asks, just shut your box.
Shut your box.
Shut that box.
Your inbox.
Yeah.
That is. Get your mind out of the gutter, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about those boxes.
Not those out boxes.
Not those out boxes.
Those inboxes.
Keep it in your box.
Yeah. Keep your box to yourself.
Yeah. Keep it to yourself. Keep your box clean.
Your box is your business.
Right.
And don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
And this is why Microsoft has gone and taken a step to promote their disablement of basic authentication. However, they've pushed that back a year because they've recognized that it's not as easy as it appears.
I'll say.
So they've now allowed you to turn off SMTP authentication for your tenant. You can also scope it to users, which is fantastic.
I don't know how to use my mute button right now. Mm-hmm. SMTP authentication. So what does that mean?
So what that means is, so printers, scanners, SMTP relay, those all are utilizing SMTP authentication. So it's when a client, you need to connect to an account, or you need to connect to something and send out email notifications, or it's using the basic authentication.
I gotcha.
Yeah. So what happens is that in Office 365, someone grabs a hold of credentials, they then log into credentials, and since it's open because you can now do authenticated SMTP relay or SMTP authentication, you can now send out emails connecting through that port as that user. Your general population does not need to have this. You don't need to have it on for everybody.
Right. Yeah, I highly recommend not having mm-hmm. that on, because then you can have anything. Anybody's anything will start emailing you or spamming you.
They will.
So can you configure, so you can disable SMTP auth inside of tenants. Would it have support for, like, say I do have a scanner that does require SMTP authentication. If I have MFA enabled, would it allow for things like app passwords or kind of the single use authentication methods?
So app passwords are not supported in basic authentication. You can still use a printer and scanner for you would just need to scope that account to be able to send with basic auth.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
But in theory, basic auth is going to be turned off someday though.
Yeah, so, it's going away. They are working on a way that to allow SMTP to be supported with OAuth. It's just right now they haven't come up with a good way to do that.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed I got a recent warning when I was using the Exchange Online PowerShell module version 2, and it was an unexpected warning. I didn't really think I'd ever have to deal with this module, and it's a situation where if you first connect using the new module, which uses Modern Auth, but you let it sit for a while and the PS session will break. So then if you call a new commandlet using this new PowerShell module, you get a brief loading screen saying it needs to reestablish the session, which is fine. But I've noticed lately I started getting a warning stating that establishing a PS session using basic auth is going to be going away soon. Please consider connecting using the Exchange Online PowerShell module V2. And I was like, but I thought this was exactly what I was doing.
But I am.
So I'm wondering if Microsoft is clamping down on how long you can keep an Exchange PowerShell session open.
I really think they are. So this weekend when I was doing migrations for Skype for Business, I was getting OAuth password entries every hour, I think it was.
Yeah, it's been really annoying for me because this is a first world problem for me, but I'm used to in the morning I open up my Exchange on-premise and Exchange Online dual sessions in a PowerShell mm-hmm. window, and I leave it open all day. But with this new module, they seem to be really strict on the timeout, and if I leave it open doing nothing for maybe about an hour or so, I notice the connection breaks, and I often have to completely close down the whole window, remove the PS session, and yes. reconnect fully from the ground up again. And that's something I didn't used to have to do before, especially with the basic auth the original commandlets with PS sessions. So, and even if you time out and you try to reconnect, it appears to not be connecting with modern auth. It appears to be connecting with basic auth, which is really strange. So you have to actually completely shut down your window and reconnect. So I think Microsoft really wants to discourage persistent all-day connections to Exchange Online.
So that's something that I definitely ran into as well, is that the error it would give me, I would enter the password and it would just keep saying, nope, 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 you can't do it. So I've had to close out of the session entirely, close out my window, close out everything I've been doing elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's pretty obnoxious.
That is annoying. And that's going to be a kind of a different behavioral change I think some people are going to have to adapt to, because I know personally I've had to adjust with that, and working from home has kind of exacerbated that, where I don't do commands in this all day as much, or I'm like kind of disrupted a little bit more. And I have coworkers also who have adopted the same method, and I think they've actually been asking me lately, they go, why do the commandlets randomly stop working after a while? And I think I got to tell them, now that I think I've heard from you corroborated through this, I think this is just how Microsoft wants it now. You're just going to have to occasionally just completely close it down and relaunch it.
So off key on the side, I mean, I've heard from a couple of Microsoft employees, they said, oh, there's an hour timeout. And I don't know if that was just because that's what they're supposed to say.
That seems to line up with the amount of time that I've observed where it breaks. Because, usually if I let it sit for an hour or more, that's usually when stuff stops working.
Around 56 minutes is when I saw it.
I'm going to have to do some time tests, maybe have some timers open the next time mm-hmm. I have the chance.
So that's definitely what I was seeing. And that dialogue seems to be new, because that was not the dialogue previously in past experiences. And that was something they were really hitting home with, is your session will time out after an hour, log back in. And I'm like, wait, what? Usually I can keep a persistent session. And they kept saying, no, 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 like you have to log back in. And I'm like, yeah, I know I'll get timed out over time because I'll be pushing too much stuff through. And that was not the case. It wasn't a matter of how much I was pushing through. It was a time thing.
Yeah, and I know that warning that showed up when I reconnect, that didn't show up until maybe about a week and a half mm-hmm. ago. So I think they're actively making adjustments on that.
That
now.
Seems like it's very new then.
So, okay, that's good to know. I'm glad to know it wasn't a problem in my own code, because I wrote a custom connection function. I'm glad to know that's more of Microsoft's end than anything else, and that's mm-hmm. just something they just want.
No, that doesn't seem to be you. And on the email security and keeping your box safe, being in the email world recently has definitely shifted to a security-based environment, but now it's more so than ever. There's been a lot more scams, a lot more phishing attempts, and they're getting better. Over the course of the past 6 weeks, I've seen them improve dramatically. more so than I ever have. These bad attack actors have shifted and they're chameleons right now. I've dealt with some that are unbelievably good.
Yeah, there's been a lot of really good social engineering ones that have been coming in, at least from my world.
Really ballsy. They'll call in or they'll reach out to vendors that you're working with pretending to be. They'll register a domain that's similar enough. And if the vendor isn't good enough to like check and see if you actually work for the company, like they'll start giving out quotes and emailing in. It's insane.
Yeah, that's not good. Yeah, they might try to do, you know, like the Homograph style, very similar domain, but it'll do that thing where if you don't have that configured, you know, using the puny code or whatever that Firefox supports,
right?
You configure it with either the extension or the about config property. Yeah, that can just contribute to the scams.
One of the craziest ones I saw recently was someone had a compromised account. And in that account, they took a CEO's signature and address. So they had a copy of a CEO's email and their signature and how they typically write. They wrote an email similar to how the CEO would write it. They formatted it all like it. They copied it and pasted it into this person's message. And then they actually started sending it out and forwarding it to other people, making it look like it was an email from the CEO.
Nice.
It was just like a copy and paste thing. It wasn't even like an original message was sent. It was, they took this person's account, they compromised it, and then they started forwarding off a message that looked like it was sent to this person and then needed to be forwarded off to other people for approval.
Deepfake technology, it's here.
Yeah, it's here. So more than ever, it's pay attention to these things. If something looks off, report it. And even IT departments need to start investing, or companies need to start investing more in email security. What your favorite flavor is, it doesn't matter. Pick one and just really pay attention.
And while you're at it, adjust your 0-65 send limit, because you now can.
Right. Do all of the things that will secure you and make your lives easier, because it's very overwhelming.
Yeah, now is a real good time to really clamp that down, get that figured out as soon as you possibly can, because those attacks are coming fast and heavy.
Yeah, so hope that helps. Keep your box safe. That's about the best advice I can give.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeez.
Jeez. All right, so this about wraps up this week. We definitely glad we took some time, not that much time, but some time.
Yeah, we definitely used some time here.
We're back. I'll say. So our question of the week, go for it.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm exhausted. I feel like I ran my mouth for way too long in this episode.
You talk too much.
I do talk too much. I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So our question of the week is, are you using ARM templates? What cool things are you doing with them in your deployments?
Yes. So to reiterate, ARM is Azure Resource Manager. So it's
I don't know what that is. Yeah. I forgot already.
No, it's okay. Azure has a lot of acronyms. And if you're even I'm having trouble remembering half of them. But yeah, Azure Resource Manager, that's kind of one of the main engines of Azure. You deploy things with JSON files as your configuration. And the question to the forum is, are you using them if you use Azure, and what kind of cool things are you doing to deploy? Are you using VMs, templates, networks, subnets, anything, load balancers, whatever you can do in Azure? Tell us, because I ain't doing anything with it yet. I have kind of a basic one that I came up with that can do a sample VM deployment with very basic subnets and configurations, but other than that, I'm just curious as to what others are doing, just to kind of get an idea as to how practical this is. I can see it being very practical. I was just wondering what other folks are doing. So if you got answers, shoot them our way.
Yeah, tell us all about it. But until then, go to HTHPC.com and...
Yeah, HTHPC.com. Rate us on iTunes. We're all over the internet in terms of podcast providers. I think the latest one we just got added to was iHeartRadio. After several weeks of approval, they eventually said yes to us, so we're on there. Yep, we're everywhere. We stream live on Twitch before the episode comes out, so you can hear us make mistakes live or have awkward pauses or forget to unmute ourselves.
Do weird stuff.
Any kind of stuff.
Hear the cat.
Hear the cat or slam doors or all the funny pre-edit live things that happen when we stream. Or my internet will cut out every once in a while, which, it is what it is. But yes, we stream live. We have a website. We have blog posts. We'll have more coming at some point when we have some cycles to do that. They're kind of, we purposely don't do anything to a schedule because, I don't know, work. Life happens.
We have and real jobs.
Yeah, despite sounding like real podcasters, we actually have full, regular, separate lives and jobs outside of this.
Yeah, so. And unfortunately, recently, my full-time job has become like a full-time and a half job.
Yeah, it happens.
It does happen. So we try to do a weekly podcast, sometimes bi-weekly, and we'll get more content up on the site someday.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be fairly recently. Things seem to be, I hate to jinx this, normalizing in the world, and by normalizing, becoming more chaotic, but normal to us.
Yes, and... I have some blog ideas. I just need to get into words and formatting and
words.
Let's just, I don't know. I could even look at the list. What do I even have for ideas? I want to do some follow-ups to some previous episodes. Like I wanted to further elaborate on how my backup system is configured and how I set it up, ways to easily update SCCM apps. So that's a follow-up from episode 8 of Hope This Helps, and how do I set up my Raspberry Pi NAS? You know, we'll get into the nitty-gritty in ways that I can't really do verbally, in ways that probably only text does justice. So
we have a lot of old content, too. And honestly, I have walked upside down, backwards, and inside out of Teams recently, so I can do how to get your anything on Teams in less than 2 weeks. So... it will be coming. It's just going to take me a little bit of time when I get the cycles.
Yep. So, we'll have good stuff coming your way. Until then, we do the weekly podcast for everything else, and we have the website for all the other needs of the Hope This Helps world.
All right. Until then, Hope This Helps.
Hope This Helps. Beep, boop.
Beep, boop, bop, boop.